I'm Brenda Power and this is The Media Show. In this edition, ideas worth spreading. Why over 800 million people are watching online lectures via TED Talks.
It really creates a sense of unity and a sense of having a cultural bridge rather than being atomized by the media we consume.
As TV3 gets ready to launch a new series, we're asking why TV soaps have so much appeal.
Do you know my mother, bless her, she was 86 and if you rang her, you'd get callbacks of watching Coronation Street or Fair City.
And we're inside News Talk.
So we set out to have a personality-led station. So our presenters from breakfast through to evening are encouraged to be opinion formers.
But first, a couple of weeks ago, we heard from some primary school children about their online habits. But what about older people? Now that everything is online, are they being left behind? Is the digital divide the new generation gap? Our reporter, Conor McGinty, talked to people in Whitehall Active Retirement Association about how comfortable they are online and what they use their computers for.
For my 80th birthday, I got a present from the children of a laptop. I get great entertainment out of it and it's an absolute Pandora's box.
I'm a dab hand at Skyping.
The kids seem to do it so much quicker. The little fingers fly over the keys where we gently pluck one here and there slowly.
I'm still a bit mystified about the downloading business and what I'm downloading.
I did take a junior lesson last year and I will go on and take another lesson this year.
I mean, I can type, I can Skype, I can send emails.
My wife is the computer woman in the family then, she does it. But I never took to it.
I've bought an e-reader, I've bought a digital camera, I now have an MP3 player and I've got a terrific digital radio. And I love being able to get radio stations from all around the world.
The websites I use at the moment are Google, YouTube and Skype. I don't go near the Twitters or that sort of thing.
I looked up recently if I was on the register of voters and that was handy. I now do my bin charges on it. When I think about it, I suppose I use it more than I thought I did.
Facebook, and I don't really understand it, but reading from the papers I gather there that you can put stuff on it, messages and things like that.
So, lots of enthusiasm there, obviously, but also a clear lack of skills and a lack of confidence online. Now, Stephanie Comey is senior manager with the BAI, the Broadcasting Authority, and she's responsible for media literacy projects. Now, while digital media literacy is not currently part of its remit, Stephanie does see a danger in leaving older people behind in the media shift online.
We talk a lot about the media literacy of children because we always feel that children have to be protected. But really, if we are 100% honest about it, the media literacy of older people is a bigger issue, in my view, than the media literacy of children, because everybody's always going to look out for the little people, but not so much for the older people. And things like access to the internet, understanding the rights and responsibilities that the internet or computer access might generate for older people isn't necessarily well done. And while they are individual and isolated initiatives by various groups who do sterling work, such as Age Action, for example, who they undertake a lot of training and computer training for older people, amazing freedom that is given to older people through enhancing their media literacy skills, there isn't necessarily a broader uniform Irish approach. Now, I'm not saying that that's the remit of the BAI because we're primarily about broadcasting regulation, but certainly in terms of a concerted approach, it might be something that we need to look at down the line.
And that was Stephanie Comey of the BAI.
So I want to talk about education and I want to talk about creativity. My contention is that creativity now is as important in education as literacy, and we should treat it with the same status.
TED Talks is a free online lecture site that promises ideas worth spreading. Speakers are invited to talk for no more than 18 minutes, and while it began as a forum for technology, entertainment and design, hence TED, the subjects now range from science to culture to politics. The TED site has had more than 800 million viewers to date. June Cohen is editorial director of TED, and I asked her to tell me a little bit about the TED phenomenon.
TED actually began as a private conference. It was exclusive and elite and small. But in 2006, TED's owner, Chris Anderson, decided that these talks really deserved a wider audience. And we began releasing them to the world online through our TED Talks podcast and our website, TED.com. And we initially thought they would just attract a small, geeky audience. And we've been amazed at what's happened since. TED Talks have actually now been watched or listened to more than 800 million times around the world, and that's a number that just continues to astonish and humble us. And we think that that's partially due to just this hunger in the world for meaning, for ideas, for stories, and for feeling part of something that's larger than ourselves.
Now, June, as you know, one of the criticisms of the internet is that it is atomizing society, you know, that it's an isolating and kind of solitary engagement. But you maintain, on the contrary, that sites like TED are actually reviving old-fashioned concepts of community. Can you just explain that to me?
What we found is that there's actually something uniquely compelling in this format, and it's really just the format of old-fashioned storytelling, that when an audience is watching a speaker, that they engage with them not just intellectually, but also emotionally, and I'd argue even physically. When you're in the presence of a great speaker here, you're almost hypnotized by them. And I think that goes back to the notion that human storytelling really is the most ancient form of media. We evolved to respond to a person telling us a story in this way.
Can you tell me your own personal favorite, if you've got one, TED Talk?
It was a talk given in 2004 by the National Geographic explorer, Wade Davis. He studies cultures around the world, and he gave this beautiful talk on the tragedy of the languages that we're losing around the world. He talks about how many traditional cultures are dying out and taking languages with them. I was just so moved by it. And several years later, in 2009, we launched our TED Open Translation Project. And this is a project that allows volunteers around the world to translate TED Talks into any language. We now have more than 9,000 translators working in 90 languages, and they produce 28,000 translations. It really creates a sense of unity and a sense of having a cultural bridge rather than being atomized by the media we consume.
And that was June Cohen from TED. With a full-time staff of just 55, that's a quarter the size of RTE Radio 1, News Talk is posing a major challenge to the national broadcaster with a daily audience of 300,000. Our reporter, Lisa Essiaman, spent a morning inside some of the station's more popular shows.
Talk radio is a tough model to produce. It's a very hungry animal. And for us to thrive in this market, we've got to set out to be extremely conscious of having a unique selling point that isn't what RTE Radio 1 do. Garrett Hart, station editor, News Talk Radio. I've been with the station from day one. The station is 10 years in existence. We began our life as a Dublin station and have graduated to a national platform. We have one main output studio. All our shows are broadcast from there. Our main listen to show on the station is The Breakfast Show, which airs from 7 in the morning until 10.
Chris, that'll be worth mentioning at the top. Paddy McDonald, producer of News Talk Breakfast.
Okay. We tried to be maybe innovative, provocative, and, you know, just to engage listeners in the morning on their way to work.
Target listener is generally between about 35 and 54. They're quite often living in an urban area. As it is, it's about 70-30 male-female.
And we'll take ads around 9:20 or so, coming back after ads.
To get people to listen to you, you have to be different and you have to be offering something that nobody else does, so there's no point in being a carbon copy of what's out there. But really, it's to a large extent also you're trying to uncover the bull that you might be fed or the spin that you might be fed by the political class or by the business class. You're really trying to get behind that and for the listener trying to interpret that for them and say, this is what's really happening. Stand by.
Welcome back to News Talk Breakfast. Our political panel are still with us. Just want to move to a different area.
I'm Chris Donoghue, one of the presenters of News Talk Breakfast. From the point of view of a morning show, I mean, why do you crawl out of your bed at 10 to 4 in the morning? You know, first of all, there are huge advantages as a journalist. We know the statistics, 85% of adults listen to the radio every day, so it's part of their morning.
I would usually be here until maybe 4 o'clock or so most days. You get home, have maybe a rest for 20 minutes, you're listening to drive time programmes from 4:30 on. Then there's a conference call. The presenters and the producers and sometimes the editor of the station would be on the call where we can thrash out the next morning's programme and what to keep or what to leave.
Okay, yeah, Des Bishop is here. Hey, Des.
Morning, guys. How's it going?
My name is Brendan Howard. I'm producer on Tom Dunn's programme. So this week is a little different. You come in while Des Bishop is filling in for Tom Dunn. We thought long and hard who we were going to get to cover for Tom while he was off. So the criteria we were looking for was somebody who wasn't afraid to have an opinion, but at the same time was empathetic and I suppose was in tune with the News Talk listener.
So we set out to have a personality-led station. So our presenters from breakfast through to evening are encouraged to be opinion farmers. It's very labour-intensive because we have to create content. In a music station, you have the ability to go and play a track for 4 minutes. We're on air from 6:30 in the morning until midnight. And we generate, on average, 4 stories an hour. So you can see the level of content that needs to be created.
Hello, Caroline, Moncrief Show.
And that was Lisa Essieman in News Talk. TV soaps dominate our viewing schedules and some of the biggest audiences across the week go to teledramas like Coronation Street and EastEnders. ITV's Corrie, which is shown here on UTV and TV3, is celebrating 52 years on our screens, with an average audience of between 8 and 14 million viewers, while EastEnders on the BBC is just 27 years on air. From the Australian teenage soaps like Home and Away and Neighbours to the more racy Hollyoaks, these TV series shape our evening viewing. Here in Ireland, we grew up on the Reardons and then Glen Rowe, and now it's Fair City on RTE and Ross na Rún on TG Cahar. But TV3 is about to add a new drama to their menu. Taylor's Hill, which is in production in Galway, will be coming to our screens later this year. Ben Frau, Director of Programming at TV3, is here to talk about this new departure and what it promises. But first, Conor McGinty has been out and about asking you about the power of soaps and why you love or hate them.
Oh, my mother, bless her. She was 86 and if you rang her, you'd get, call back, she's watching Coronation Street, or call back Fair City.
It was Fair City because there's a bit of reality about it.
I enjoy a bit of soap there in the evening, just to sit down and relax and chill out.
I think they're a waste of time. They don't entertain me. I prefer to watch Tom and Jerry.
I think they sort of portray most of real life that we all sort of go through. Sometimes I think the acting in Fair City mightn't be 100%, but I do like the storylines.
There's an addictive element to it, and maybe a lot of people sort of identify with it, but that's the very reason that I don't watch it.
The only thing about it is after you miss two or three episodes, you can come back the next week and still follow it.
Coronation Street, Emmerdale, Fair City. It's a bit of humour in them at times, you know, it's easy watching.
It's a pastime when they get accustomed to living with the characters and they're involved in the scenes and the storylines, and it's an escapism.
I'm joined now by Ben Frau, Head of Programming in TV3. Ben, your new series then, Taylor's Hill, begins broadcasting in the autumn. Tell me, what's the thinking behind this?
TV3, having made great strides really in its own home production in terms of reality shows and documentaries, etc., and entertainment, felt it was time to investigate drama. It's a very expensive genre, but working with Moira Nuhuhill and Tyrone Productions, we think we've found a way of making a drama series that is affordable to us and that will hopefully add some texture to the autumn schedule.
So what is it? Is it a drama? Is it a soap? What's the difference?
A soap is two things. One, it's obviously long-running and has a huge cast and storylines that go over a long period of time. Secondly, I think soap operas tend to be slightly more colourful in their storylines. And I think Taylor's Hill, we're not going to be really launching a soap here. It's too big a hurdle to jump. Let's just concentrate on trying to do 6 1-hours of good drama with great characters that may yet lead to a soap in the future. We'd certainly like it to, but let's not aim too high too quickly.
So give us an idea where you're pitching this then.
There's a fine line between footballers' wives and love-hate. And I'm very clear that we're not doing footballers' wives. We're not looking for camp. We're not looking for over-the-top.
You're filming in Galway. So why did you choose that location?
Well, we picked Galway because we had to go for somewhere that was cost-effective. Well, we are utilising a lot of the talent from Ross na Rún, which is, I have to say, a soap opera that I'm a big fan of. Filming it out, you know, in the West is a practical thing to do. And its approach that we're taking is to film in the way that Brookside did on a real estate, using real houses and not using sets, which is something I was very keen on. It's not actually based anywhere. You won't know that it's in the west of Ireland. It could be anywhere. It is a part of Ireland that is hopefully representative of many parts of Ireland.
And now, Ben, you talked earlier about how expensive drama is to make. So how are you going to fund this series?
It's a sort of tri-production, 481, the BAI, Sound and Vision Fund, and my programming budget, which is not quite as big as it was before we started doing drama. It is phenomenally expensive for us compared to documentary making or, you know, reality shows.
And do you think Taylor's Hill could sell overseas?
Possibly. We've had quite a lot of success with selling programmes on, but maybe a bit of a dinosaur in that I don't think about the overseas market, but I really think that content has to come first. Let's try and get it right. If it's good, I believe it will translate.
And that was Ben Frau, Director of Programming in TV3. As more and more news content moves online, many of us now get our news through our smartphones and our laptops. And thanks to services like RTE Player, content is much more accessible because viewers are no longer bound by a schedule. The RTE News Now app, for example, has had more than 600,000 downloads. So as well as offering a service to users, though, the Digital Forum also offers a potential new revenue stream for the station. Myrna Laffin is Managing Director of RTE Digital. Myrna, what trends are you seeing here?
Already 50% of our overall online traffic is coming through mobile. So that's been really exciting. We launched RTE Player 3 years ago and launched iPad and iPhone versions before Christmas. So I think that what we're doing is we're bringing the great RTE content to new audiences, and we're making sure that we are making RTE programmes available to them on their terms. We are looking at connected televisions, where we will be launching RTE Player. We are bringing more socially enabled opportunities, if you like, to RTE Player already on mobile. We have RTE News Now, which is the most downloaded Irish app, over 600,000 downloads. So we'll be looking to develop that. For example, make more clips available, make more audio and video available on it, just bringing more content. The beauty of digital is that it gives, if you like, airtime to content that doesn't make it online. And I think that producers welcome this because they get the opportunity to do slightly different things. But also really key is that we are making a lot of moves to give our users opportunities to engage in the content. So, for example, we launched a new Life and Style Hub 3 weeks ago, and that has community aspect to it. For example, on the food side, you can put up your own recipes, you can comment on recipes, you can rate recipes, you can give your opinions on what's going on. And that's something that we're very keen to do. Social media integration is one of our key priorities. Projections are that by the end of 2015, 80% of televisions will be internet enabled. So we're looking to build apps for our content on those TVs. And that's really key because that brings a different experience into the home. RTE Player has about half a million users per month. And we don't believe that it impacts negatively on TV viewing. We believe it's additive. And in fact, we know, for example, if you're a viewer of a television series and you drop out, it's really hard to get back. And because you have 21 days to catch up, if you miss an episode or two, this gives you an opportunity to get back in. Also, if you miss the beginning of a series, it's really hard to kind of get engaged. And the player gives you that chance. And we're seeing, you know, a lot of programmes that wouldn't necessarily be in the top 10 on television actually make it into the top 10 on player. So that's great because it really is giving those programmes a chance to reach an audience. We're definitely reaching a different audience with mobile than we are on TV and radio. I think it's younger, and I just think it's a different audience. They want different things and they want it on their terms. The revenue is growing and we have very good year-on-year growth, but it's still a small base. So it doesn't compare, for example, let's say, to the size of television revenue. However, one of our objectives with the new digital strategy is that we want to be 15% of commercial revenue by the end of 2015. We're currently tracking around 5%. We have a long way to go. However, it's not just going to be about advertising. We see the big opportunity, in fact, actually moving into the paid content model. That doesn't mean that you will now have to pay for your RTE content online, certainly in Ireland. But we have a very big international audience. So we see that we could, for example, make certain archive or subscription services available. Things that, for example, you just wouldn't be able to get as part of your regular free online offering. And we think that there's a good opportunity there. We also want to see a lot of our merchandising available online. They tend to be, for example, TV shows tend to be DVDs. Because of the size of the market, you can't actually put that many of them out. But we think that this is an opportunity through digital to make a lot more content available and maybe make it available on a pay basis or a subscription basis. So that's going to be, we think, a new revenue source for us.
Myrna Laffin, thank you very much for that. And this week's Media Watch is from Pauline Sargent.
Over the last few years, Ireland has seen a move towards hyperlocal websites that provide local communities with various forms of hyperlocal content. These can take the shape of news, views, events, local sports stories, to regular updates on residents and parish council meetings. Boring to some people, but you know, in reality, it is much needed in a lot of areas because these meetings and minutes get hidden. The hyperlocal landscape in Ireland has yet to be mapped. It is estimated that Ireland has roughly 20 active hyperlocal websites. These hyperlocal media websites are run by local people like me with a huge amount of passion and engagement for their local areas, mainly on a voluntary basis. A Kilcullen Diary and Ballybohel.net are great examples of well-run hyperlocal websites in Ireland. My own one, Drimna Is Good, is one such site that was set up to provide Drimna with a strong online voice and to talk Drimna up rather than down. The characteristics and content of each hyperlocal service is dependent on the need of the local community being served. Some have grown out of the need to hold local authority to account, others to define local identity, like Drimna Is Good, and others to express democracy in innovative ways. The main driver of these sites is the easy access to online publishing tools such as WordPress, Audioboo, YouTube and Facebook. It is one of the reasons why I started Drimna Is Good, because I could do it myself and it cost relatively little. People are embracing these social media tools and are able to access local content that matters to them in real time. One of the key points about hyperlocal websites is that they are in the main run by a member of the community, like me, rather than just an employee of a large media organisation. They are visible and highly engaged in the local community, and I feel they can really make a difference.
That was Pauline Sargent, who runs the website Drimna Is Good. Throughout this series, we've been hearing a lot about how online and digital is changing journalism. New terms like crowdsourcing and data mining have been cropping up, so our reporter Paula Kniff has been finding out more about what some of these terms mean and how people are using them.
Gavin Sheridan runs TheStory.ie, an online news site which has been at the forefront of innovation, using freedom of information legislation to get public access to data on public spending. Their work in the Department of the Taoiseach was released online and picked up by the Irish Times. I asked Gavin about the background to the story.
What we had originally been doing in 2010 was looking for specifically expenses data. The difference with the Taoiseach data that we got was that we went instead looking for expenditure data. So we went to the Department of the Taoiseach at the end of 2011 and said, can you give us all of your net expenditure, non-salary? And that's kind of a change in tack in terms of the perceptions of using FOI in different ways, partly as a transparency advocacy point of view and saying, well, this information should be public anyway, why isn't it? And then essentially publishing it. But also from a journalism point of view, trying to get large databases and saying, there might be stories in here about public spending or perhaps the misspending of public money. It's a new way of approaching the same idea of journalism, which is who, what, when, where, why, how. It's just a different type of information and it's just a different type of way of analysing it.
The Freedom of Information Act has been around for quite a while now. What is it and how are journalists using it?
All citizens have a right to access information using the Act. It's €15 per request, so it's not as heavily utilised as it might be otherwise. But the Act allows and gives a right to citizens to get information from public bodies about themselves or about general information. You can ask for specific stuff that you might be interested in your local community, or if you're looking for information about something that's bothering you, about something, some perceived waste of taxpayers' money or something. But generally, the access to information movement globally is getting bigger. The amount of countries that are passing access to information laws is growing. Brazil just passed its access to information laws at the end of 2011. Spain is the last country in Europe to enact its law. It's currently been drafted. It's also fairly heavily used in Eastern European countries. And it's also, particularly in Eastern Europe, where constitutions were written more recently, they have access to information enshrined in their own constitutions rather than through laws.
Could you explain to me exactly what you mean by data mining?
one thing that's becoming very clear is that the amount of information that's being published, either by governments or by individuals or by companies, is increasing. And that's not just Twitter, it's also databases, it's also large volumes of information, it's spreadsheets, it's all that kind of stuff. Our core philosophy at the start was digitize everything. Every piece of paper we get, every database we get, every piece of data. But it would be readable, it would be published in its raw format as well for the public to get. Over the next few years, I think we'll make newsrooms far more efficient and also journalists far more proficient, because it will make information available at their fingertips in very sophisticated ways, because the technology that's out there for managing information is getting better all the time. It's not going to replace traditional journalism where getting sources and knowing people and chatting to people on the phone or going out on the ground. It's not going to replace any of those things. It's just a new interesting addendum, and it also brings new challenges in terms of skill.
So when you published the data on ministerial expenses, what was the impact of that?
And we published it online, and the Irish Times came across it and said, oh, this is an interesting story. So Harry McGee in the Irish Times looked at the data and then analysed it and summed all the information and said, there's a few stories in here around money that was spent by the Department of the Taoiseach on a private chef for cabinet meetings during the IMF bailout. And again, this kind of leads to the question around, well, what's the purpose of just putting the information up raw? Oftentimes, because the story.ie is run in a kind of a pro bono capacity, but sometimes I'm just so busy with other stuff, I just go, okay, I'll just publish it. And if somebody wants to do a story, and I go ahead. And fair play to Harry, he picked it up and did a really good job of analysing it. So there's kind of that idea that sometimes you just want to act in the public interest purely and just go, here is what we have. And if anybody wants to analyse it, please feel free. And we may or may not do it ourselves, but we think the information should be out there.
And that was our reporter Paula Kniff talking to Gavin Sheridan there. I'm Brenda Power, and you've been listening to The Media Show. Well, this is the last show in the series. Thank you for listening over the last 8 weeks. And don't forget, you can find podcasts of the whole series and full interviews on rte.ie/radio1/The Media Show.